You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
From the heart of where innovation, money, and power collide, in Silicon Valley and beyond, this is Bloomberg Technology with Emily Chang.
I'm Emily Chang in San Francisco, and this is Bloomberg Technology. Coming up in the next hour, China on lockdown, sparking a sell-off across Chinese stocks, delays in exports of just about everything to countries around the world, and comparisons to the 2008 financial crisis. This on top of concerns about China's ties to Russia. We will discuss. Plus, Mark Zuckerberg lays out his vision for the metaverse at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. From avatars and creators to the future of work, we'll critique his take on the economies of the future. And my exclusive conversation with the brand new CEO of Allraise, working to raise up more women in tech, how she plans to make much needed change that has so far seemed impossible. Mark Zuckerberg speaking at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas, laying out his vision for the metaverse and how he believes Meta is building the fundamental technologies that'll make it possible. Let's dig into that conversation with Bloomberg's Kurt Wagner, who covers Meta for us. And Kurt, looking at the highlights from this interview, I know we were hoping for some hard news questions, for some commentary on what's going on in Russia, Facebook and its properties getting shut down. That's not so much what we heard today, is it?
No, it's not. Mark Zuckerberg started the conversation by acknowledging the elephant in the room. Of course, this war that is going on, his service is kind of at the center of a lot of the information sharing that's happening there. He said the things that you're supposed to say. He said, hey, I'm thinking of the people in Ukraine. There's not much, you know, that I can say that will do justice to what's happening there. But really, he didn't get into any of the specifics, and he didn't take any questions about the specifics. And I think it's just yet another sign of how much he's giving that portion of Meta's business, that portion of Meta's operations, over to Nick Clegg, the head of policy there, who's been very forward and public about the company's stance in Russia and Ukraine over the last couple of weeks. So this was him kind of acknowledging what he felt he needed to acknowledge, but then moving on to what he wants to talk about, of course, which is the metaverse.
And not just the metaverse, but the economy of the metaverse. I want to take a quick listen to a clip from that conversation earlier.
These are going to be basically creators who are basically building all of these different experiences. And I think that's going to create this massive new economy around a lot of this that that hopefully will support many, many millions of jobs and people doing the kind of creative work that that they want to, instead of maybe the kinds of jobs that they feel they have to today.
Kurt, do you buy into this idea that the metaverse will create a truly new economy? For example, how many new jobs will this create?
I couldn't tell you how many new jobs, but I do think that it's going to open up a lot of probably commerce-related initiatives and opportunities that we don't think about today. You know, he talked about the idea of even dressing your avatar, right? And just similar to how you have a wardrobe at home, you choose what you want to wear for work, for dinner, for play, whatever it might be, you're going to be presumably doing that with your avatar too. Your avatar is going to show up in different settings, and you might want to dress or act differently in those different places. Presumably, you might actually spend money on those digital clothes, right, in much the same way. So that's just one example, but you could imagine that expanding to a bunch of different things, you know, workouts, concerts, all the types of stuff that you spend money on today in the real world, but doing it in a digital environment. I think that's what he envisions as this economy surrounding the metaverse.
Meantime, just a couple days earlier at South by Southwest, I asked former Nintendo president Reggie Fils-Aimé his thoughts on Facebook and Zuck's view of the metaverse. He is not optimistic. Take a listen to a portion of that conversation.
I'm not a buyer of that idea. I don't think that their current definition is going to be successful.
Why not?
Why do I say that? I say that because first, you know, and I don't know if anyone from Facebook is here, but you have to admit that Facebook itself is not an innovative company.
Not mincing words there. Facebook is not an innovative company. I'm sure that's not something Mark Zuckerberg would want to hear.
No, not at all. I mean, but it's hard to dispute in some cases because a lot of the stuff that Facebook has done really well have actually been inventions that were created by other people, right? I mean, they acquired Instagram, they acquired WhatsApp, they acquired Oculus. And while they certainly helped build those services into what they are today, a lot of the features that we know, stories, reels on Facebook, which is kind of a TikTok clone, right? Facebook has become known for a lot of things that other people came up with. Now, maybe that's the difference between inventing something and making it massively popular, which is something they're capable of doing.
All right, Bloomberg's Kurt Wagner, thanks for breaking it down. Meantime, last week, Bloomberg News reported that buy now, pay later lender Affirm delayed a proposed asset-backed bond sale after a major investor in the top-rated portion of that deal backed out last minute due to market volatility. I spoke about this with Affirm founder and CEO Max Levchin, but started by asking about the conflict in Ukraine, a country he fled as a child. Take a listen.
I have people there. I have still relatives, friends, former classmates, colleagues, it's horrible what's going on there. And I think the human cost, it's now of crisis proportions. Don't have to be born in Kyiv, Ukraine to understand just how awful it is, but certainly does not help to recognize the streets in some of the footage. I've been very focused on trying to channel all of our family charitable contributions to refugee helping charities on the Polish border. I think that's probably the most concentrated thing one can do right now financially to just try to offset some of the damage.
Now, it's also having a macroeconomic cost, as we're seeing. John mentioned Affirm halting this big planned bond sale or asset-backed securities, a big investor pulling out. It seemed like this was going to go through. Why did that investor pull out?
So that's actually, probably pretty important to set the record straight. So I'll start from afar, but I'll cover this very carefully. So first of all, we've known each other for a long time. You know that I'm an engineer and think like an engineer. So we built the entirety of a firm through this whole engineering concept of full redundancy and resiliency. So our servers have tons of redundancy. Our products have a lot of ways of accomplishing the same thing. Our funding for our loans, since we're not a bank, we have to fund loans from the outside, has lots and lots of redundancy. We have asset-backed securitizations, which is what we're talking about here. We have warehouse lines where we basically place these loans into a warehouse arrangement. Then we sell our loans directly through forward flow arrangements. The deal that we were contemplating executing last Friday was a refinancing of an existing asset-backed security. One of the investors, as you correctly pointed out, felt that the market volatility overall just made them decide to pause a purchase of bonds. And the deal had a real opportunity of becoming economically less financially attractive to us than our other funding sources. So we very quickly pivoted to place the same assets to a much better economic arrangement. And so it is correct that we decided not to do this deal, but this was entirely an economic choice on our part in favor of a firm. And part of what we said yesterday to sort of highlight the point of this isn't just a choice we made specifically because, you know, that's what I wanted to do for funding. Our profitability guide was raised specifically to make the point that even as we shift between these different funding sources, we're not going to see any deterioration of our margin. In fact, we intend to improve it and expect to improve it.
Right. So will you launch that deal again? And if so, when, especially in the context of the market volatility that we're talking about?
We're certainly always looking to both expand our funding sources, and this is not our first deal and certainly not our last deal. And as we watch the asset-backed securities market, we'll certainly come back to it with other products. You know, I've literally spoken with a handful of ABS investors in the last 24 hours and asked them, so how do you feel, you know, just trying to get market color? And the answer has been, oh, you guys are the quality, and the market is definitely very volatile, but the flight to quality, this accretes to you guys. And so we'll absolutely launch the next deal when the time is right.
Affirm founder and CEO Max Levchin there. You can catch the full interview at Bloomberg.com. Coming up, the future of money. We're going to hear from Mike Novogratz on Bloomberg's new crypto show to talk about the role of digital assets in the war on Ukraine and more. Next.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop. Customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Global stock markets have whipsawed investors in recent weeks with the war on Ukraine, yet Bitcoin, usually no stranger to wild moves, has been locked in its narrowest trading range in more than a year, a trend that's likely to continue, according to Mike Novogratz of Galaxy Digital. He joined Bloomberg's new crypto show, Bloomberg Crypto, earlier with Matt Miller and Kaylee Lyons. Take a listen.
Let's say the dollar might never be the same, right? I mean, I think the biggest thing that's happened in the last 10 years in lots of ways, maybe longer, is when Europe, the U.S. said, hey, Russia, those reserves that you thought were yours, they're not really your reserves. So what does that mean? It means the dollar or treasuries as a risk-free asset isn't so risk-free. It's not risk-free if you're Russian, and maybe if you're Chinese, you're like, it might not be risk-free either. And so I think we're entering in a world that's unknown, where people are going to struggle to figure out what is the reserve currency. The U.S. isn't going away, right? The dollar's not going away, but it's not going to be the sole place. And so I think you're going to see this hodgepodge of assets. Gold, certainly digital assets are going to be part of that bucket. The whole world's not going to flip to Bitcoin overnight. But you're going to see more and more people say, I want to have some of my money outside of the sovereign.
How do you deal with that debate, though? Because a lot of people are talking about the problem with cryptocurrency is that you can use it to circumvent these sanctions. On the other hand, people in the community are saying, that's the point, right? We don't want government censorship to be able to take away our property.
So let's talk big and small. There is zero chance the Russian government can use cryptocurrencies to circumvent. Right? We're regulated by 25 different agencies, Galaxy. And I'm sure, you know, FTX and Binance and the others have just as many. And so almost all crypto moves through exchanges. Those exchanges have KYC AML processes, just like TradeFi exchanges. And so, plus Bitcoin is a public blockchain. Mm. You know, way back we hired Mike Morrell, who had run the CIA. We, Galaxy, and a few other companies to do a study on Bitcoin. And he did like a 10-week exhaustive study with the security agencies, with the three-letter agencies, with crypto companies. And he came up with a thesis that if you were going to design a trap to catch criminals. It would look a lot like the Bitcoin blockchain. And so it's just, Elizabeth Warren is just wrong when she thinks you can use Bitcoin for Russia to exceed sanctions. And we're looking at it the wrong way. The Russian ruble has depreciated over 90% in the last 10 years. Just this year alone, I think high to low is like 65%. The Turkish lira did the same. Bitcoin is a lifeline to people in countries with really poor stewardship of their economy. And we should be thrilled that Russians can get some of their money in Bitcoin so they're not completely broke holding worthless rubles.
Well, that brings me to the question of what the use case is, because in the context we're talking about it, it's essentially as a replacement for fiat currencies. Is that how you view what the future of digital assets is?
Listen,
is it a store of value?
So digital assets is a big word, right? I think Bitcoin has this really beautiful lane of being digital gold or a store of value. Everyone has a human right to have the fruits of their labor stored somewhere. And if you don't trust your government's currency, traditionally we put it in diamonds or gold. This is the first really digital version of that. And so I think that's Bitcoin's use case. Now listen, there's also a lot of other digital assets. There's digital stable coins or digital dollars or euros. There's things, Ethereum, digital networks, NFTs, right? And so the revolution that's happening isn't just in one lane. But I think for Bitcoin, it really is a place you store value.
Galaxy Digital head, crypto investor Mike Novogratz there. You can now catch our weekly Bloomberg Crypto Show every Tuesday, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, co-hosted by my colleagues Matt Miller and Kaylee Lyons, where they cover the people, transactions, and technology shaping the world of DeFi. Welcome back to Bloomberg Technology. I'm Emily Chang in San Francisco. 2 years into this pandemic, working women and especially moms are struggling. We've seen women leave the workforce at historic levels. A new global study found that last year alone, roughly 26% of women left their jobs between just March and September alone, most because of their responsibilities to care for others. Joining me now, Reshma Chowdhury, founder of Girls Who Code and the author of a new book, Pay Up, The Future of Women and Work and Why It's Different Than You Think. Talk to us about where we are right now as the pandemic hopefully winds down. What are we not seeing? What's different than we think?
Well, I think we know that workplaces have never worked for women. And over the pandemic, you know, women found themselves without childcare, with managers who didn't get it, with partners who weren't doing their fair share. And now women are in crisis. Millions of women have left the workforce. 51% of working moms say they're anxious and depressed. We can't go back to a broken system.
What can business leaders do right now to support women and moms in the workforce? And I'd love to hear your thoughts on the tech industry in particular, where it's so male-dominated.
Yeah, well, we have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. As you know, Emily, the recent jobs report that came out, 11 million open jobs. CEOs are desperate for talented workers to fill those jobs. So it's a seller's market right now. So I think women have an opportunity to ask for what they need. And what we need is affordable childcare. What we need is paid leave. What we need is employers who are going to support us on our mental health. We can ask for what we need. We don't have to go back to the old normal.
There are companies like Netflix, like Microsoft, eBay, with really strong family and parental leave policies. Is that enough, or do we need something at a national level? And if we need something at a national level, why has it been so hard to make that happen?
I don't think it's enough. Look, many tech companies are doing, you know, they're making progress, right? They're offering some of these benefits. But for example, some technology companies like Facebook offer more in helping you freeze your eggs than in childcare. And we know that the reason why women are not returning back to work is because childcare is too expensive. Most families spend more for their mortgage, more for their childcare than they do for their mortgage. It is literally the largest expense for families. Paid leave. It's not good enough just to tout that you offer paid leave. Companies like Apple still don't have gender-neutral paid leave policies in 2022. That's archaic. So you can't just offer these policies. You have to mandate that men actually take them, tie it to performance review, change the corporate culture. You know, Emily, we're just in the middle of Women's History Month, and we just went through International Women's Day. Today's Pay Equity Day. And in every single boardroom, there's a conversation happening about how to get a mentor, how to get a sponsor, how to learn how to be an investor. The conversations that I want to be happening is how to get your partner to do more laundry, how to get the men in this corporate culture to do more laundry, how to make sure that we audit our corporate policies so that they're not exacerbating gender inequality at home. Because until we get to gender equality at home, we're never going to get to gender equality in the workplace. And quite frankly, corporate feminism has been taking us down the wrong path. And I realize that, you know, for the past 10 years, I've been telling young women to lean in, you know, to girl boss their way to the top, that right. Equality was just, an express train to the corner office. And I found myself in the pandemic with two little kids trying to maintain a full-time job, and it nearly broke me. And I realized that having it all is just a euphemism for doing it all. So we have to stop trying to fix the woman and fix the system. And that includes technology companies who often tout that their policies and the fact that they're trying to lift women up. Well, now it's time to get men to do more, right?
Let's talk about that, Reshma. It doesn't help that there are tech founders and investors out there like Joe Lonsdale perpetuating stereotypes about men taking parental leave. This tweet from him just a few months ago saying, great for fathers to spend time with their kids and support moms, but any man in an important position who takes 6 months of leave for a newborn is a loser. In the old days, men had babies and worked harder to provide for their future. That's the correct masculine response. I mean, there are almost no words. No words.
No words. I mean, almost so many female founders I know get asked, well, are you planning to have kids? You know, when are you going to have a family? It's as if being a mother is a distraction to your job. And it's why we have the motherhood penalty. You know, the reason why we have a pay gap is between mothers and fathers. The minute you become a mom, suddenly you're less committed to your job. You're unable to build the next Facebook or the next Twitter. And so we have to root out that discrimination, which is at its core. And oftentimes in tech companies that think they're libertarian, they think they're a meritocracy, you know, they do it the worst. You know, in many ways, rooting out the motherhood penalty is just an algorithm away. Tomorrow, every single one of the Fortune 100 companies could get rid of the pay gap if they wanted to.
Well, appreciate you out there trying to shatter some of these stereotypes. Reshma Shaljani, author of the new book, Pay Up. Always great to have you here on the
show. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Tesla is raising prices on all of its electric cars after CEO Elon Musk said costs were going up. The cheapest Model 3 in the U.S. is now just under $47,000. Credit Suisse says the price hikes were between 3 and 5% in the U.S. and China. Coming along. Speaking with Joe Lubin, Consensus CEO and founder and Ethereum co-founder, about their massive new round of funding and the future of blockchain companies as they lean in to the metaverse.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop. Customer satisfaction scores would rise and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Year thought we'd be a 30,000, 50,000 range in Bitcoin, risk to the upside, not the downside. But I think, you know, 5 years out, if Bitcoin's not at 500,000, I'm wrong on the adoption cycle. Right? We see an adoption cycle that accelerates. Bitcoin grew so much faster last year, crypto grew, than the internet did in its best years in the 90s.
Mike Novogratz there of Galaxy Digital saying Bitcoin could hit $500,000 within 5 years. I want to kick off our crypto report now with our crypto contributor, Shanali Basik. Shanali, bold prediction there from Mr. Novogratz.
Bold prediction. And to get there, you would have to have Bitcoin rise more than 12 times, Emily. So you have to wonder, what will it take to get there? And what does that adoption curve look like? Bitcoin is trading below where it was this time last year. We have seen, if you take a look over here at the chart, a few days of a lift here, but that still leaves you only under 40,000 per Bitcoin. So there's a large question about exactly that. What does that adoption curve look like? Last year, there was a ton of companies, a couple of sovereigns that have started to discuss adopting it at a greater rate. But what is 12 times the rate that we've seen prior?
All right, Shanali, stick with us. I want to bring in our next guest, Consensus CEO and founder and co-founder of Ethereum, Joe Lubin, whose company just announced a new $450 million round of funding. Huge round, Joe. And I want to talk about how you're using this funding and also putting it to work in kind of a different way. Explain that.
Thanks, Emily. So we are taking in, we've taken in $450 million in our latest raise, and we've been working on being a crypto native company. We've been working on progressively decentralizing ourselves for years. We built infrastructure in the form of a consumer wallet, in the form of a MetaMask institutional wallet, and we built institutional grade staking facilities, and we are converting the vast bulk of the proceeds of the raise to Ether, both because we have staking infrastructure where we can generate yield on that, but also in advance of the merge where Ethereum 1 and Ethereum 2 affect the transition between proof of work and proof of stake, and that's going to ring in an era of what we like to call ultrasound money, where the Ethereum token becomes a very important financial instrument in the global economy.
All eyes on that merge, Joe, indeed. You've surpassed 30 million monthly active users with your Ethereum-based crypto wallet, MetaMask. And I'm curious how much awareness this is driving around Web3 and what's it going to take? What number is it going to take for Web3 to hit mainstream?
So we're seeing a lot of crossing of the chasm. We're seeing cryptocurrencies, DeFi, NFTs crossing the chasm into mainstream adoption. Very recently, we've seen another major crossing where nation states are considering this technology to be of national security importance. Virtually every nation state has to get savvy. They have to start experimenting with the technology and gaining expertise and really wielding the tools of the blockchain and crypto ecosystem, because if they don't, their neighbors will. And monetary systems, financial systems are being wielded as weapons on the global, the geopolitical stage right now. And this technology is going to flip everything upside down, make it more bottom-up, build a new trust foundation, essentially nation states are jumping in already. So it's elements like that that will drive adoption. It's elements like sports
Joe.
Leagues and many other platforms that are starting to make use of Web3.
Joe, to that point, you know, there's a lot of conversation over the last year on how to think about Bitcoin versus Ethereum and how Ethereum will get greater adoption on a global scale. How do you see the conversation playing out as people make decisions on what they're going to operate on?
So Bitcoin is a very important construct. We think of it as digitally sound money, where gold is physically sound money. Ultrasound money is this new concept where the Ether token is burned on every transaction, and a huge amount of Ether is being frozen, essentially reducing the supply on the market via staking in the protocol itself as we move to proof of stake and staking in DeFi and in decentralized organizations. And so I think Bitcoin will have an important role going forward as a money, but Ether is a fuel for the entire decentralized protocol economy, which is going to eat the world. And ultrasound money is a deflationary money. And so we expect a huge amount of value to mm-hmm. move into Ether in the next few months.
You mentioned DeFi, but I'm curious about your take on NFTs here, Joe. We see volumes trending downward. Do you see this space being stagnant? And if it grows more, what would be the catalyst to help it expand once again?
So our ecosystem moves in massive surges and consolidations. So from tokenization to ICOs to DeFi 1.0 to NFTs to DeFi 2.0 to DAOs. And so we're going to continue to see major new constructs emerge in our ecosystem. They tend to happen on Ethereum first. And each one drives a lot of excitement, some irrational exuberance. And months of high intensity activity and growth of the ecosystem and increase of value. But then we see consolidations as things shake out, and each of these pieces become fundamentally important. They become a foundation for the next fundamental construct to potentially be built. I don't know exactly what the next phase is, but all of us in the ecosystem essentially use these more relaxing periods to gird up our teams for the next wave.
Joe, a group of your former employees and shareholders are asking for an audit of a transfer of assets, including intellectual property, you made from Consensus AG to Consensus Software, Inc. What's your response to this quickly?
So the mothership, Consensus AG, has invested in north of 200 projects, has incubated many of those projects internally. We spun out 40 or so of those projects. MetaMask and Infura and our protocols team spun out together. So we've transferred intellectual property in many situations into startups. The group in question is seeing the value, the success that Consensus Software Inc. is having now, and they would like to apply the current valuation to an event that was priced by PricewaterhouseCoopers at arm's length and done in the darkest moments of COVID. Right. And so it's an unreasonable ask.
Unreasonable ask. Got it. Joe Lubin, co-founder of Ethereum, CEO of Consensus, along with our Shanali Basak. Thank you for taking the time. Accelerating the success of women and people of color in technology. My next guest has spent her career trying to do just that, and now she has a chance to shift into high gear at Allraise, the nonprofit with the singular goal to diversify the tech ecosystem. Joining me now, Mandela Schumacher-Hodge-Dixon, the new CEO of Allraise, in an exclusive interview. Mandela, thank you so much for joining us. You were named after Nelson Mandela, so I imagine change is something that is incredibly important to you. How are you going to change something, specifically the representation of women in technology, that so far seemed impossible to change?
Wow, the million-dollar question. Well, thank you so much, first of all, Emily, for having me here. I am beyond honored to be in conversation with you. And just like you said, my origination is in an interracial marriage of two civil rights attorneys who were part of grassroots movements like the apartheid movement, the anti-apartheid movement. And you can just imagine the conversations around the dinner table that we had. But empathy, inclusion, diversity, justice, seeing people, valuing people is a core part of my DNA. And I definitely will bring that to the work at All Raise, where we support the success, like you mentioned, of women and non-binary leaders in tech. And I think the thing that I'm really going to add to it is my long history in community development. We support funders, founders, operators, LPs, angel investors. When you think about all the prongs of the tech ecosystem, they are within the All Raise community. We are 22,000 strong. And I think that going forward, if we have a more unified approach to how we are going to create seismic change, then I think that we'll start having different outcomes.
All Raise was founded by power women investors who come from competing firms but all want the same thing: more women writing checks, more women getting funded. What have they told you that they want you to do differently in this next phase of All Raise?
Yeah, well, there's a big focus on the founders. So the founders are the entrepreneurs, and they're really the linchpin of this entire ecosystem. And one of the stats that's I know you know very well and that you report on a lot is this 2% number, this 2% of funding that is going to women founders. And I want to clarify for everyone that it's a little bit deeper than that. It's actually 17% of venture capital in 2021 went to female founders. But if you break that down, 15% of the 17% went to mixed gender teams, whereas 2% went to female founded only teams, right? So we are seeing an uptick in the capital flowing to female founders, but whether or not they have a male co-founder, right, that's something to dig further deep into. But this question around why 2%, why does it keep staying here? I really want to ask a different question, which is who is owning this capital that is making the decision not to deploy more capital to female founders, right? If we continue to give the same types of people the same opportunity to take a swing at bat, of course they're going to have a higher probability of hitting a home run. Part of right. the issue is giving women and non-binary leaders a swing at bat so we can get our capital, our mentorship, all hands on tech, access to the portfolio founders, access to all that comes along with the capital to really have it be a strong arm in our business to get different outcomes.
And spinning those numbers a slightly different way, that means more than 80% of venture capital is going to all male teams,
yes.
right?
Yes.
You were one of the first Black women to be raising money in Silicon Valley. And I'm curious how that personal experience is going to inform the work that you do.
Yeah, you know, one of our board members, Jess Lee, who was the first female partner at Sequoia Capital, one thing that she brings up oftentimes in our conversations and even with our All Raise community this morning is this notion of me being an insider, but having empathy and a deep understanding of being an outsider, right? Just like you mentioned, this is back in 2011, before, you know, Jesse Jackson was in Silicon Valley knocking on the doors of all the tech companies, demanding for them to release their diversity numbers, before this really became a mainstream topic. I was a Black woman from, at the time, living in Los Angeles, who has a background as a teacher, trying to break into this world. I had many things stacked against me, right? My pedigree, my identity, my lack of insider knowledge. And so I have a deep understanding of what it's like to break in as an outsider, and also what it is like to transition from a founder, a two-time founder, a two-time operator, an investor, an LP. All of these hats I've worn in my now 11-year career out here. And so right. that is part of the magic of what I'm bringing to All Raise, of just understanding the nuances of this ecosystem.
Well, change is certainly not going to happen without a healthy dose of reality, but also optimism. So I appreciate hearing a little optimism in your voice. Mandela Schumacher-Hodge-Dixon, the new CEO of All Raise, thank you. We will be cheering you on. And that does it for this edition of Bloomberg Technology. We're going to be joined tomorrow by Aaron Levy, CEO of Box, along with Jared Spataro, Corporate Vice President of Microsoft. He'll be talking about the future of work. That's tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.